Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The traditional rights of families to care for their dead is the topic of this, the first of two programs on the funeral industry in the United States, with Lisa Carlson and Joshua Slocum, co-authors of Final Rights, Reclaiming the American Way of Death. Final Rights tells the story of the loss of control over what to do at the time of a death in the family, the euphemisms regarding death, and laws and regulations in each of the 50 states and Washington, D.C. The chapter, Tricks of the Funeral Trade, tells how when grieving the loss of a loved one, many people don't compare prices and are vulnerable to suggestions that their love for the deceased is measured in the cost paid for the funeral, casket, and burial. Lisa Carlson directs the Funeral Ethics Organization, funeralethics.org. Josh Slocum directs Funeral Consumers Alliance, funerals.org. The Final Rights website is Final Rights, that's FinalRights.org. In our first interview with Lisa Carlson, recorded from her home in Vermont on August 26, 2013, she begins with a description of how the common lore of what to do at the time of death has been lost.
In a matter of just a few generations, we have lost the common lore of what to do at a time of death. Years ago, it was the women in the community that would come and bathe the body, dress the body. The men would build a casket, dig the grave by hand. Now, instead, everyone assumes that you call a funeral director and the body is whisked away. And it's not even in the front parlor anymore as it used to be. So kids grow up pretty removed from what happens at a time of death.
So how was this done? What prompted this radical change?
I think a number of things influenced the change. We started turning medical care over to doctors. We moved to apartments and didn't have large homes anymore. We moved away and were scattered. We weren't clustered as a family. And so it was convenient to have a funeral home. The other thing was that after embalming was introduced and Lincoln's body was trained around the country after having been embalmed, everyone seemed to think that that was the thing to do, to embalm the body. And in fact, in maybe 13 or so states, the law was passed that required embalming in the case of diphtheria, smallpox, those diseases back then that were particularly deadly. And that was the worst possible time to embalm a body. And certainly families don't do embalming. That absolutely necessitated using the funeral director. And the funeral director kind of puffed himself up as a keeper of the public health. That kind of backfired on the industry in the 80s when the AIDS came out. And suddenly they started freaking out and not wanting to embalm because, of course, the lie had been exposed. Embalming doesn't protect the public health at all. I think the boomer generation is an information generation, and it's a generation that started writing their own wedding vows, demanding the right to homeschooling, natural childbirth, instituted hospice care. And so now extending from hospice to the home funeral idea is just timely in the progression of things.
Let's talk about the public health for a minute, because I think that's an issue that has been mentioned to me time and again. about embalming, caring for the dead pre-burial and post-burial. Can you address the public health issue?
Yes. Nature has a wonderful way of dealing with things that we forget. In England, after the plague, the deaths were buried in mass graves, and before long, the microorganisms just disappeared. However, the wealthy that were buried in lead-lined coffins still contained the bacterium. So there's a perfect example of how nature will take care of things. And we bury our pets in the backyard. If we're not talking some kind of communicable disease, contagious disease, a natural death is just not an issue. You want to be away from a water supply, just like you don't want a dead mouse in your water supply. E. coli bacteria aren't very healthy, but they eventually break down in the soil. So as long as a person is buried away from a water supply, there just isn't a problem. And in fact, here in Vermont, you have to be buried 5 feet under. When the natural microorganisms that speed decomposition are most active in the first 3 feet of soil. So it really would be better to bury people only 3 feet under.
Lisa Carlson, some cemeteries require vaults, and I would like you to describe for us what a vault is.
A vault is like a cement septic tank, although you can get really fancy copper-lined ones. And all it is a maintenance feature for the cemetery. It keeps the ground from caving in when the casket disintegrates. And they cart away, when they dig a grave, they cart away the displaced soil, put the lid on the vault, roll the sod back out, and they can go back to mowing tomorrow on a level surface. Otherwise, there would be a heaped-up mound from the displaced dirt.
When you say when the coffin or the casket disintegrates, the earth is displaced, that would just be a minor cavity in the land.
Yes.
But we don't see that in 300 to 400-year-old burial sites in your part of the United States, in New England.
Actually, the cemeterians say it's really quite frightening to be walking around in an old cemetery and suddenly have your legs sink in up to a hip. So there is kind of a safety issue. Certainly, the well-tended cemeteries, as the grave starts to sink, will fill in the indentation.
So if the indentation is filled in, that would solve the problem?
Yes. And in fact, I think for some of the green burial cemeteries, or cemeteries willing to set aside areas for green burial, they may charge an extra maintenance fee for doing this. But the family has saved money by not having to buy a vault, so it kind of works out in the balance.
Let's move on to green burials. What are they?
Actually, the Muslims and the Jews have been doing it for eons. A green burial is allows the body to return to the soil naturally. No embalming, no metal casket, no vault, and preferably in natural fiber clothing.
Right in the ground?
They're right in the earth. And there are all kinds of variations on green cemeteries. Some are conservation land, such as Memorial Ecosystems in South Carolina. That was the first one in the U.S. They have a number of woodland burial, natural burial spots in England. You can still have a green burial in a section of a manicured cemetery. You might have a garden park. So you could go anywhere from a totally natural, low-maintenance type of burial park to something much more formal and anything in between.
Lisa Carlson, in your dual capacity as co-author of Final Rites, Reclaiming the American Way of Death, and in your capacity as the head of the Funeral Ethics Organization, you describe your goal in your book to raise the bar for ethical practices in funerals. Where is the bar now? Where has it been? Where would you like it to be?
Unfortunately, a lot of the public are willing victims. We teach our kids about money, politics, religion, and maybe sex. We don't do a very good job teaching them about death, dying, and funerals. And in fact, very often, people seem eager to prepay for their funeral. And in fact, the industry will say, oh, spare your children. Well, actually, you may be taking away from your children a therapeutic involvement when you prepay and pre-plan everything ahead of time for your own funeral. The industry in many states is oversupplied. Consequently, it's a situation that invites abuse. In Pennsylvania, in Vermont, they're fighting over dead bodies. I got a death threat for diverting one family to a more affordable funeral home from a rather high-priced funeral home. And that's certainly not true of every funeral director. I am proud to call a number of funeral directors my friends. In fact, Theo just got a $250 donation from a friendly funeral director. And the good guys and good gals in the business are infuriated by the ones who taint the business. But an educated consumer makes it difficult for the industry to pull mischief, which is why I'm passionate about funeral education. And the reason Final Rites has a co-author on this edition, which is really the third edition of my book on funeral law for consumers state by state, is that Joshua Slocum is much younger than I am. It's the only book on funeral law in the country for consumers, and Josh will keep this information in print when I'm pushing up daisies.
You mentioned mischief on the part of funeral directors. I'd like to know what you mean, but before you describe what this mischief may be, I want to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Lisa Carlson from her home in Vermont. She and Joshua Slocum are the authors of Final Rites, Reclaiming the American Way of Death. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Lisa, what's the mischief?
Well, here's a funny one. I, for many years, was subscribing to probably more industry rags than most funeral directors actually read. And Funeral Service Insider had a symposium on how to add more funeral dollars to your cremation calls. And one of their bits of advice was, if the family has not selected one of your more elaborate cremation urns, and you send the cremated remains back to the family in the box that comes from the crematory, stamp a temporary container on all four sides. And I thought, Lordy, that's a sleazy tactic. That'll never happen in Vermont. Well, my father-in-law donated his body to the med school, and about a year, year and a half later, we got the box from the crematory, and there it was stamped, temporary container. Well, I had to laugh. I really hadn't thought it was going to happen in Vermont. And I was in Montpelier at a legislative discussion on regulations for the crematory business, and one of the funeral directors in our conversation group worked at the crematory that had done my father-in-law's cremation. So after we were through our regular discussion, I said, Bob, I've got a bone to pick with you. And he kind of sat up straight in his chair. And I mentioned the sleazy tactic of stamping a temporary container. He said, well, it is a temporary container. I said, oh, no, it isn't. I said, my father-in-law very much believed in education, and he is now a permanent traveling display on your sleazy tactics. So Josh and I will take Grandpa Charlie with us when we go out to give a talk.
And what was the gentleman's response?
I think he just didn't know what to say at that point. He was appropriately embarrassed.
Is this an indicator of the financial interests of the mortuary associations?
Well, I think when you've got an oversupply in Vermont, if we were to die Monday through Friday with one funeral a day and 2 weeks off for the funeral director's vacation, the death rate in Vermont could support 20 full-time funeral homes. We've got 70. So, and this kind of statistic is true in most of the states except for the West Coast. On the West Coast, the supply and demand are in much greater balance. And actually, prices go down when you have a better supply and demand. In places like Vermont and Pennsylvania, where you have an overabundance of funeral homes, the high overhead facilities are underutilized, and they have to raise their prices in order to support that kind of expensive overhead.
As in any supply and demand situation, don't they take the risk of not getting enough business to even meet their costs?
I don't think they collude to keep their prices high, but they all keep them up. Most consumers don't price shop. Funeral directors will admit they're seeing more funeral shoppers now. And one of the nice things that the Funeral Consumer Alliance groups do is a price survey, which is very helpful because most people will shop for a computer, shop for a car, but they don't shop for a funeral. And the thing that they forget, if they're not holding services at the funeral home, then it doesn't matter if you call an out-of-town funeral home to pick up the body and drive it to the cemetery or crematory.
You imply there, Lisa Carlson, that drive it to the crematory or the cemetery. Let's move our discussion to home burials, the status of them, where they are permitted, where they are prohibited, California being one of the states where it's virtually impossible, but not completely, to get a home burial.
Actually, the laws in California are kind of all over the place and kind of funny. In one statute, it states that six bodies constitute a cemetery. And you have to wonder, did they expect all six to die at once? Or can you call it a cemetery once you've accumulated six bodies? Another thing in California, what California law says, you must be buried in an established cemetery. But establishing a cemetery is probably the purview of the local municipality. And if Michael Jackson's family had contacted me, I would have urged them to contact the local town where Foreverland, or whatever it's called, is located so that they could consider a family cemetery on his property. But I think it's wonderful, absolutely wonderful, that you've won the case to allow your client to remain buried on her own property, which is very much in the American tradition. If you drive around the country, almost every farm in every state is likely to have a family cemetery out in the country on the farm. And that's a wonderful American tradition, and it should certainly be allowed.
I just want to mention here for listeners who may not be familiar with a recent case that was won here in Mendocino County, California. I represented a family who chose to bury the wife on their 47 acres as explicitly directed in her will. And there was a challenge from the local county government. We took it to court and we won. Lisa, as I'm able to discern from my own research and your book, California is one of the very few states where home burials are either so complex to have permitted that it's virtually impossible. Why is this, and what are some of the other states?
Washington State is another one that comes to mind. Indiana is another one that requires an established cemetery. Trying to establish a cemetery makes it very difficult. Ironically, Michigan, which is one of the 8 states that require the use of a funeral director, has one of the best home burial statutes. So you've got to hire a funeral director to hide behind the apple tree if you want to be buried at home in Michigan.
So what is the state's interest, if any, to require that a burial only occur in a pre-approved cemetery or an established cemetery, presumably pre-approved?
I think some people worry that crime is going to be committed and they're going to dump Granny over the back 40 to speed her will along. I think that just doesn't happen. If someone is going to commit a crime, they're going to do it regardless of any cemetery law.
In your research, Lisa Carlson, what purpose is there to a cemetery-only law as a place for burials?
None.
What's the situation in the state of Vermont, where you live?
Vermont requires being buried either on your own land or in a cemetery. And one nearby town has conservation land that they don't want to plat out. They don't want a fence, all of which is required for a typical cemetery. So we want to add our natural burial ground to the statutes. And yet we've got a cemeterian lobbying against it. And I think it's because of his own sense of self-importance. I think he feels threatened somehow by something that would be different from what he's doing, which is nonsense. There should be, you know, lots of ways to skin the cat.
Lisa Carlson, what is the value from your research and from your experience of a home burial?
I would vary that phrasing a little bit to include a home funeral prior to cremation, not just burial. And that's where a family takes charge, primarily without a funeral director, possibly with limited use of a funeral director, maybe for transportation, but where the family files the death certificate, bathes and dresses the body, and possibly transports the body to the cemetery or crematory or for home burial. And the advantage is that having something to do takes away the sense of helplessness. There's a pediatric oncology nurse in San Diego who found my first book and started using it with her parents. When parents have lost a child, there's a dramatic difference in the healing, she says, when they have a hands-on funeral experience. That is probably true for any tragic or untimely death, where people have not had any anticipatory grief, anticipatory goodbyes.
Well, Lisa Carlson, what brought you to this industry, to this endeavor in your life?
When my last husband died, he committed suicide at the age of 31. I knew when I married him that suicide was always an out for him. He was a super sensitive person. He was a first grade teacher, and our kids were eligible for free lunch at school, which will tell you what first grade teachers made in those days. I had almost no money in the bank, and so I asked a friend to help me drive his body to the crematory. We lived out in the country, but the ground was frozen. So even though we were married at home, burying him at home was not an option in the winter, and that was why we opted for cremation. With my permission, there was a lot of publicity about the fact that I had done this without a funeral director. And for the next year, a week rarely went by without a phone call or letter from other people wanting to know what to do and how to do it. And I had read an article from one of the other writers in my writers group on how to bury your own dead in Vermont. That was what gave me the information when I needed it. Sally wasn't going to do anything more with that. So I thought, I wanted to follow through, and I went to the state law library. I figured if it was the same in every state, it was a magazine article. If it was different in every state, maybe it was a book. And indeed, I found enough differences state by state that I thought it should be a book. I sent out an outline and sample chapters to 26 different publishers, small, medium, and large. And walking home from the mailbox at the end of our driveway, my 5-year-old daughter would say, "Another ejection, Mommy?" And after 26 ejections, I put it aside. I was unbelievably fortunate enough to remarry a year and a half later. And Steve, also a writer, knew I needed to see this book in print. After his mother died of AIDS in 1986, again a death that we handled as a family, we decided to put this book in print. It was at a time when the small press movement was exploding, and anyone with a computer could get a book in print. And indeed, it hit the New York Times as a news story, and I ended up on Donahue, Good Morning America, CBS This Morning. And things kind of took off from there. Once I got involved in the funeral consumer movement, I was interested in the rights of all funeral consumers, not just the do-it-yourselfers. And consequently, that's one reason the book has so many pages in it, that we cover cemeteries, crematories, but we cover the waterfront on the industry in that book.
Well, Lisa Carlson, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious, and I think you have told us quite a bit about yourself, but I want to ask you a couple more questions, if I may.
Sure.
Is there an epiphany or an aha moment in your life that you live by that perhaps wasn't part of the story you just told us?
It's happened any number of times, but I know that after the first edition of my book came out, a woman wrote me that the book had totally changed her life because it had given her control over something that she had felt totally helpless about. And that kind of empowerment gave me an enormous high. And it consequently, I get high a lot by empowering other people.
What would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
Finish the Christmas quilts I promised my kids 10 years ago.
And finally, is there a book or a movie that you would recommend to our listeners?
I read mysteries, and my husband and I share reading back and forth. John Grisham, that kind of thing.
Well, Lisa Carlson, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Lisa Carlson and Josh Slocum are co-authors of Final Rites, Reclaiming the American Way of Death. The book's website is finalrights.org. That's finalrights.org. The books Lisa Carlson recommends are those written by John Grisham. I invite you to listen to our interview with Josh Slocum, found on the Radio Curious website, where more information on this topic is also found in the Law Department at radiocurious.org. Over 400 Radio Curious programs may be found on our website, radiocurious.org. They're free as my gift to you. I hope you enjoy them. Our address is 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah, U-K-I-A-H, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541, and email is curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onnestad is our assistant producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.